The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. We're going to talk about health and healing. My guest, which will be a newsmaker guest, a short segment in about 15 minutes, will be Keith Fitzgerald, and he's going to talk about that $600 trillion derivative time bomb and Wall Street's new death derivatives, things you haven't heard about that are very important. We're going to talk about. Arm yourself against the flu. Don't get the flu shot, according to what the science says. An original in-depth analysis by myself and Dr. Nancy Ashley. Then, our issue of the day, and I will be dealing with hospital infections, a new breeding ground for superbugs that you've never heard of. But our issue of the day will be, is the national security complex, just like the big banks and Wall Street, too big to fail? Tarping War by Tom Englehart from Tom's Dispatch. We have a lot to share with you. Let's get right at it. The latest study on stress shows that when your cortisol levels go up, and every time you are stressed, your cortisol levels will go up, that's a bad thing. Why? Because, well, first, cortisol is a glucocorticoid steroid hormone produced by your adrenal glands. And every time you get anxious, depressed, angry, low levels of these blood glucocorticoids are released. That causes your blood sugar to go up, and that's called gluconeogenesis. Now, elevated levels of cortisol and other glucocorticoids cause calcium depletion of your bone. In lay language, the more stressed you are, the more you're destroying your bones. So, by being relaxed and doing some good stress management, that'll help keep your cortisol levels down. And then, of course, there's a lot you can do with anti-inflammatory diet, rich in phytonutrients, your fruits and vegetables, which, by the way, along with good healthy fats from coconut and avocados, olive oil, walnuts, are excellent for you. That also helps your body and helps mineralization. Getting a good night's sleep with melatonin being secreted, that's good also for anti-inflammation. And clean water. And every time you have a glass of water in the morning, make sure you put about a teaspoon of fresh lemon juice into that water. That's really good for your digestion, good for rebalancing pH. And then if you find that you are out of balance, maybe you're working too much, not sleeping enough, then take a few adaptogenic herbs such as ashwagandha, rhodiola, ginseng, and astragalus. All good and all able to help you. And then some vitamin D3, and you've got good, strong bones. Now, eating broccoli is important, but eating broccoli sprouts are even more important. A quote, up to 50 times more cancer-fighting benefit than broccoli alone. I'll quote this from Natural News. Paul Fawcett says, quote, most of us know something about the health and cancer-fighting benefits of broccoli. Sprouting increases the digestion and health benefits of whatever is sprouted. Find out about the health benefits of broccoli sprouts, and it's good for you. Now, then it goes into what's in the broccoli sprouts in this particular report, but it says that the best thing to do is have broccoli and broccoli sprouts together, and I would agree upon that. So if you want to help prevent cancer, broccoli sprouts. They are terrific. And by the way, you can put broccoli sprouts in a salad. And I don't recommend juicing broccoli sprouts because you're not going to get a whole lot of juice out of them. But you can certainly throw them in a blender, and that'll get you the juice out of them. Next up, a lot of people do indoor swimming in the wintertime. All right, well, that's good. But make sure that there's no chlorine in the water. And almost all of your commercial pools, and even indoor swimming pools, have chlorine. Instead, better by enormous measure is ozone. If you ozonate the water, you're killing more bacteria, more viruses, more quickly, with no adverse health effects to you. Here's the latest science on this, and this is from the International Journal of Andrology. It says, quote, indoor chlorinated swimming pools may damage future fertility in children. It goes on to talk about what chlorine does to the mothers who are swimming and how that impacts upon their developing fetus. So keep away from chlorinated water wherever possible. It's not good for you. Antibiotics killing off good bacteria for good. This is an important study, and here's what it says. And this is in the major publication Nature. I'll quote it. It's an accepted concept why now that taking antibiotics in order to quell an infection disrupts the personal microbiology, the population of microorganisms that we all carry around in our guts, and which vastly outnumber the cells that make up our bodies. That recognition supports our understanding of a particular CD disease, that's a particular type of bacterium, and killing the beneficial bacteria allows the C. diff room to surge and produce an overload of toxins, as well as the intense interest in establishing a recent program that could demonstrate experimentally whether the vast industry producing probiotics products is doing what it purports to do. But implicit in that concept is the expectation that after a while, after a course of antibiotics ends, the gut flora repopulates itself to their natural balance. What if that expectation is wrong? Let me just put this in lay language. Right now, as we speak, millions of Americans are taking some form of antibiotic. A lot of them are in hospitals doing that. And what we've seen is hospitals are very dangerous. I mean, not just for the patient, even visiting a hospital, because almost all the surface areas in a hospital are contaminated. And there's a particular really bad bacteria, killing bacteria, and it's called C. diff, D-I-F-F. And that's a Clostridium difficile. And it's everywhere. And it comes through feces. Now, how in the world do you get feces everywhere in a room? Explosive diarrhea. When you have explosive diarrhea, what happens is, if you notice, a lot of the toilets in hospitals don't have seats. So when you flush, that goes back up into the air. And this reminds me of something that happened a long time ago. We had a lot of people at the Institute coming down with infections. Now, I worked upstairs, and it had its own private bathroom. Downstairs, about 40 different scientists and attendants all use the same toilet. So on just a hunch, I took the leading microbiologists and virologists, and we lathered the whole bathroom, this small little bathroom, we lathered it in agar, what goes in a petri dish, and that's what you grow cultures in. And once it was completely lathered, we said, whoever next uses the bathroom, just leave the toilet seat up. Don't put it down. And then once a person left, about an hour later, we went in, and there's a infrared a counter, and it counts the bacteria. And this thing just 500,000 bacteria and 27,000 viruses from one toilet being flushed without the seat down. And every square inch clear up on the ceiling, you could have that. So in effect, that means that every time you flush a toilet, or anyone in your house flushes a toilet and they don't put the seat down, it's like the toilet just sneezed. So all that fecal matter goes everywhere. It lands on your soap, your toothbrush, your wash rags, every part of the sink, the knobs. And then, of course, you go in there not knowing this. You don't see anything. And you touch the handle that someone washes their hands with. Now, do you ever realize when someone wipes themselves, every little stain and microorganisms on that hand now is on the handle where you wash? Now, the proper way of doing it is you should disinfect this with alcohol or hydrogen peroxide or a combination of both, or use a paper towel, but people don't. So then they wash their hands, but they're washing their hands and then turning off the water faucet with the same dirty water faucet handle. Now you reinfected your hand, or you use a doorknob that's infected. So now we're finding that, okay, so a person goes into a hospital, they come up with this infection. How do they get the infection? Now, this is a new report that I just read this morning from Anneli Rufus from Aldernet, and it says this: hospitalized for pneumonia, Lisa Thayer's mother was suddenly gripped with painful cramps and a bout of diarrhea. It had an unusual and terrible smell, a gross, almost sweet smell that the staff immediately recognized as C. diff. Thayer had never heard of C. diff, a potentially deadly colon-destroying bacteria. It spreads via fecal-oral contact. An infected person's feces contains bacteria that form sturdy, disinfectant-resistant spores that can survive in the open for 5 months. 5 months! A hand touches a contaminated surface, then a person touches their mouth. Think you're not eating crap well in the hospitals, you are. According to a recent article in American Family Physician, 13% of patients hospitalized for up to 2 weeks will contract this. 50% of those hospitalized for 4 weeks will contract this. And you needn't be a patient to catch it. All you need to do is visit a hospital. Over the last decade, C. diff has morphed into a superbug. A new epidemic strain emerged in 2004 that is now making C. diff ever more virulent, drug-resistant, prevalent, and lethal. How lethal? Well, last year, C. diff alone killed 30,000 Americans. We think of hospitals as places where diseases go away, not a place where you can get sick, but that's what they are, far more commonly than the healthcare industry wants us to know. In a crisis that costs us $40 billion a year, millions of infections are contracted annually within the ostensibly sanitary institutions. Collectively, they're called hospital-acquired infections, and patients face a really grave condition. And like MRSA, Staphylococcus aureus killed 18,000 people last year. So we're talking about a lot of people. You contract it through a cut in the skin, and MRSA can cause deadly bone, blood, and organ infections. Nearly 90% of MRSA's cases originate in hospitals. So just think of all the doorknobs, telephones, trays, uniforms, wheelchairs, drapes, furniture, switches of lights, linens, toilets, sinks, walls. That's where you pick this up. So when people say, gee whiz, Gary, aren't you being a little extreme on this hygiene business? Okay, well, let's say I'm a little extreme. But there were almost 100,000 people who died in the hospitals last year from infections. Had the hospitals been more extreme or the patient, they'd be alive today. So when being conscious saves your life, you bet I'm going to be conscious. Always best just to take some chopsticks with you to a restaurant, and or take your own silverware. And I always take the paper towel that I'm given there, not a paper towel, I take the linen that they give you in a restaurant, and where they wipe off with all the other dirty bacteria and viruses and food particles that just smears it around, put a cloth over that so when you're leaning your hands and elbows on, you're not picking up that infection. Just assume that you could pick up herpes and other conditions from the glass and silverware and plates. And that way, be conscious. All right? That's why I don't drink. Well, I don't drink with a meal in any case, because it dilutes digestive acids, which is not good. But just be conscious of simple hygiene. All right? Use paper towels to open and close doors, turn on and off faucets, and use even the plunger, the soap, use a paper towel. This way, you're not likely to infect yourself. Otherwise, oh yeah. Now back to the main story. So we think, all right, so we had some antibiotics, and it killed off some bad bacteria. And then everything's going to be okay. The good bacteria will come back. No, it won't. That's what we had always assumed. In a provocative editorial published this week in Nature magazine, Martin Blaser of New York University's Medical Center argues that antibiotics impact our gut bacteria and it's permanent and so serious in its long-term consequences that medicine should consider whether to restrict antibiotic prescription to pregnant women and young children, not allowing them to have it. So they found that it doesn't come back. Your friendly, good, healthy bacteria never fully recovers. And the long-term changes to the beneficial bacteria within people's bodies may even increase our susceptibility to infectious disease. This is how we have to look at it. Overuse of antibiotics could be fueling the dramatic increase in conditions such as obesity, type 1 diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, allergies, and asthma, which have doubled in our population. And among the findings he cites in support, the population level observation that the incidence of infection with H. pylori, the bacterial cause of gastric ulcers, has declined over decades, just as the incidence of esophageal cancer has risen. So, now, here's my argument. Knowing now, for the first time, that our belief that your bacteria will rebalance, and they don't, all the more reason every day to take good, healthy probiotics and recolonize your intestine and use natural antibiotics that do not kill off the good bacteria, such as colloidal silver, bee propolis, wild oregano oil, astragalus, paldiarco, and also, well, you could use colloidal gold as well, and olive leaf extract. These are all extremely effective of killing off pathogens in the body, but not healthy tissue. And last but not least, ozone. Quite simply, ozone is a miracle treatment, and I've seen it help save lives. So that's the latest from Health and Nutrition Update Information. Now, before we take our break and come back with our guest, I want to give you our issue of the day, and I won't do all of it, but enough for you to get the idea. Think of Iraq as the AIG insurance of wars, the only difference being that the bailout of AIG didn't involve just three payouts. More than 8 years after the Bush administration invaded that country, the bailout is, unbelievably enough, still going on. Even as U.S. military withdrawals, the State Department is planning to spend billions, hundreds of billions more in taxpayer dollars to field an army of hired gun contractors to replace the ones we're withdrawing. And also think of Afghanistan. It could have been the Lehman Brothers of conflicts, but when Barack Obama entered the Oval Office, he chose the Citigroup model instead and surged troops twice in 2009. In other words, he double-tarped that war, and ever since, the bailout money has been flooding in. Until now, as the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations make clear, too big to fail has meant only that one set of institutions, the plundering financial outfits that played such a role in driving the U.S. economy off a cliff in 2008, look like they might themselves collapse in a heap of bad deals and indebtedness, and were bailed out by Washington. Isn't it finally time to expand the too-big-to-fail category to include the Pentagon, the U.S. intelligence community, and more generally, the national security complex? There is, of course, one major difference between those bailed-out financial institutions and the complex. However powerful the banks may be, however much money financial outfits in Wall Street sink into K Street lobbyists and the election campaigns, politicians, however much influence U.S. Chamber of Commerce may wield, when too-big-to-fail financial institutions totter, they have to come to the federal government, hat and future bonuses in hand. For the Pentagon and the national security complex, it's quite another matter. These days, it's only the slight exaggeration to claim that they are Washington and that their very size, influence, and power protects them from the consequences of failure. In the last decade, as troops became sacrosanct and the secular equivalent of religious icons, they also help ensure that no Congress could afford not to pour money into the Pentagon. Pay no attention to the much-touted $450 billion that institution is expected to trim over the next 10 years. That sum will largely come from cuts in future projected growth, and anything more will be strongly resisted. In that same decade, thanks largely to two hijacked planes that damaged New York beyond Al-Qaeda's wildest dreams, American safety, narrowly defined as from terrorists, became the mantra of the moment. Soon enough, it was the explanation of choice for any expenditure. The latest drones, surveillance equipment, high-tech motion detectors, peeping Tom technology at airports, the troops translated into a get-out-of-jail-free card for the Pentagon, and it worked like a charm. In the 3 years since the economy melted down, when so much that mattered to most Americans was being cut back or deep six, that budget was only expanded, not constricted. In the meantime, there were those constant infusions of fear about America's safety, helped along by terror plots generally too inept to do the slightest damage. All this ensured that an already massive crew of intelligence outfits would morph into a labyrinth bureaucracy of stupefying proportions. That same phrase fertilized the Department of Homeland Security, the Homeland Security State that went with it, and an immensely lucrative Homeland Security industrial complex that went with that, all growing at a remarkable clip. Imagine for a second that at the height of the Cold War, someone had told you of a future in which the United States faced no armed great power, not one, and at most a few thousand terrorists scattered around the planet, as well as modestly armed minority insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. Imagine that person making this prediction as well. In budget and size, the national security complex of that moment would put its Cold War predecessors to shade. Without a doubt, you would have dismissed him as a madman. If someone had proposed such a future to those running the Cold War back then, they would have called it victory. And yet, that's exactly our reality today. While victory itself has become the rarest of vintages, no longer stocked anywhere in our American world. And then it goes on to talk about, no matter how much they want to spend, no matter what they want to spend it on, they get it. No matter what you need, you won't. Bare bones. We have a massively corrupt bureaucracy. It is inept, it is corrupt, it is inefficient, and we are spending ourselves to death in order to get it. The trouble is, those people who historically would have been responsible and reasonable in saying, do we need this bureaucracy? Do we need this size bureaucracy? Should we have some control over what it does and how it spends its money? And none of that is in place. Neither the right nor the left has made this an issue. There is no issue. There are no marches. There's no demonstrations. And I interviewed over 400 people in the demonstrations now going around the United States. I couldn't find one of them who could define for me accurately the military-industrial complex, what its budget was. And when I told people it's $1.3 trillion a year, and it takes away your privacy, and everyone here is being photographed, and you're now on a terrorist watch list, and you don't have habeas corpus. They didn't know that. And one person said, what's habeas corpus? And this is a graduate from Rutgers University. So the issue is, shouldn't we be concerned about completely deconstructing the massively fraudulent, self-serving, inefficient military-industrial complex and have one rule in America? If you are not doing good for the American people and have transparency and can show it, then you shouldn't exist as an entity. And that way we could take away $1.2 trillion. Imagine what that would do to free up money in the United States and lessen our debt. And do you think any of that $1.2 trillion out of $1.4 trillion makes us safer? It does not. It's just all about Washington, D.C., the bureaucracies, the old boy system, who pays to play, who opens up a company when there are already 14 companies doing the same identical work, and they add another one because a legislator to the Pentagon says, this is someone from my town, give them a $100 million contract, no bid. The corruption is massive. So I believe that we should not allow anything to get so big that it it can't fail. We have to bail it out. And that includes taking them all apart. The big banks, deconstruct them, take them through bankruptcy. And someone on Wall Street in those demonstrations should start a whole new concept. Outlaw derivatives of all types. Make them outlawed completely. And then they'll come back and say, what's a derivative? Well, in a moment, I'm going to show you what a derivative is and why it, more than anything else in the financial market today, will determine your future. Oh, yeah. Stay tuned. Keith Fitzgerald, Chief Investment Strategist for Money Map Press, which publishes Money Morning, specializing in global markets, a former professional trade advisor on global future trading and hedging. He has founded the Keno Circle in Vienna, Austria, and he's in Portland, Oregon, and he's going to talk to us about this and why we should pay some attention. He is the author of Fiscal Hangover, How to Profit from the New Global Economy. We'll be asking about this $600 trillion derivative time bomb and Wall Street's new death derivatives. Please stay with us.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
I'd like to welcome you from around the world. If you have a comment on allowing the military-industrial complex and the spy complex and the CIA and all these other agencies to have unlimited amount of money, power over our lives, the rights to arrest any American, to assassinate any American the president wants to see assassinated, to do anything it wants, with never once being held accountable and no one ever going to jail for anything, well, that's what we have. What are your thoughts on that? Give us a call at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Now let's say hello to Keith Fitzgerald. Nice to have you with us today, Keith.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Keith, you wrote the following. You said, do you want to know the real reason banks aren't lending? And it's because the risk in the $600 trillion derivative market isn't even out. To the contrary, it's growing increasingly concentrated among a select few banks, especially here in the United States. You talk about how 95.9% of all U.S. derivatives are owned by four banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs. And you talk about these derivatives playing a crucial role in bringing down the global economy. So here's my question. Take us through this.
Okay.
From what I've been able to determine, there's approximately $60 to $70 trillion in the world, period. I mean, if you took every penny, dollar, gold, silver, put all the world currency together, you got between $60 to $70 trillion. So how in the world are people gambling at 10 times that for $600 trillion when we don't even have that currency? And why should we allow that? And what are the consequences if these people end up on the wrong side of this bet? Because you know and I know the Federal Reserve will bail them out with our money, but that's going to create an enormous problem for us. Take us through this scenario, please.
You bet. Okay, so the first thing we need to do, Doc, is we need to sit down and say, okay, what is a derivative contract like this? You know, what are these things really? And ostensibly, Wall Street says they're insurance. Now, in the old days, if you thought about insurance and you owned your house, you couldn't get insurance unless you owned the underlying asset, because the insurance company wanted you to have the incentive to protect your asset. That way, they could make a calculated bet on the likelihood that you would default or your house would burn down. Wall Street in 2000 created, or a little earlier than that, they created these special derivatives, credit default swaps, interest rates, all kinds of things. Now they can buy fire insurance on your neighbor's house. So instead of having an incentive to preserve these things, now they have every incentive to burn them down. And where this matters is that they are completely unregulated. They are outside the normal exchange mechanisms, which actually, you know, like Wall Street, London, Tokyo, those things actually work very effectively because there is transparency. But in the derivatives market, it is ostensibly a self-policed industry where everybody's on the honor system, and supposedly they are valuing each other's contracts. Well, you and I can both see this one coming a mile away. It may be worth $100 million to me. It may be worth $500 million to you. But the point is, we don't even know exactly how much is out there. There's $600 trillion of derivatives, insurance bets on other people's assets that we know about. We don't know how much we don't know about. So it could even be bigger than that. Where this comes full circle with regard to bailouts in Europe and the United States, for example, is that our governments and the central banks around the world have decided that they're going to bail out these institutions instead of letting them fail. Now, I've been very vocal since the very beginning of this crisis. History is littered with the bones of failed financial institutions. And the way to bail out an economy is not by throwing more money after bad. You just simply can't put more debt on top of bad debt that's already gone bad. That's what they're doing. And that's why the traders in these things have continued to concentrate their risks and continue to trade them even now, and why the risks are getting more and more concentrated. Because if they've got trillions of dollars of risks out there, they have to continue to make self-perpetuating trades to pay for the risks that they've already got on the table. This is like going to Las Vegas and not being able to walk away when you're losing. You have to continue to place these bigger and bigger and bigger bets just to stay in the game. And the federal government, the central bankers, are letting them stay in the game instead of outlawing them.
It's absolutely corrupt. It's unethical what's happening, because
it's criminal, in my opinion.
It is criminal. And let me give you a little quick scenario, and you can give me your opinion on this. I believe that the Greek unions will have to continue. They have no choice. They will have to continue strikes. And then behind the Greek unions, there is going to be a confrontation with the government, and I believe that the Greek people will throw the existing government out of power in the next 6 months, because they can't take any more austerity cuts. They're cutting education, food, they're cutting their pensions by 20%, and 30,000 employees for the government being laid off. The union will have no power and have no safe face saving unless it does demand this. But at the same time, the European Central Bank, International Monetary Fund, and Wall Street says, oh yeah, you better pay us. And they're saying, but hold on, for every dollar we bring in, we owe $1.92 in expenses and debt. We'll never get out of debt, and our economy is going bad. And they say, we don't care. Come up with the money, sell off your national assets, sell off islands, sell off monuments. We can take one of those monuments, and we can turn it into a hotel. You know, that we can always, there's always a way to exploit something. We can put toll booths on all your, like we do in the United States, and on your roads. So it's just a rape of a country. And the talking heads on Wall Street seem to say, well, that's a good thing as long as the banks are made whole. And I'm saying the Greek people will not tolerate it. They'll bring down their government, then they'll default, much like Argentina did, and they'll go off the euro. When that happens, I predict Spain, which has a higher unemployment rate than the greatest housing crisis in Europe is in Spain. More homes are foreclosed on, more people are unemployed in Spain, and Spain had a much stronger economy than Greece. I think Spain will follow, then Ireland will follow, Portugal, I believe then it'll get such a crisis that Germany and France will have to cut loose those poor southern nations in the Eurozone. I believe that will cause a flight to the dollar out of the euro, and then people thinking that the dollar is strong won't look at China. And I believe that China, I know China is offloading an enormous amount of the dollars. And when they get to a point where they can feel that they can really go forward with the BRICS nations on a currency to replace a mixed currency, to replace the dollars as the reserve currency, I believe that when that happens, our dollar is going to crash. We're going to go into the deepest depression with greater so. They're nonviolent. Some are focused on the right things. Most are not. They're not going to do anyone any harm. But the people behind them will. The next people you see taking the streets will be in the next 2 to 3 years, and those will be the poor working class. They're armed, angry, and up to this point, they haven't shown themselves. They will in time. So we could be seeing all this happen. Now, the missing link in this is the derivatives. If it is shown that someone, one of these Goldman Sachs, loses a lot of money on Greece because they're heavily invested in Greece, in derivatives, and bonds. If any of these people lose a lot of money and the Federal Reserve comes over and it gets known that the Federal Reserve bailed out one of these people when they were just gambling, that could be the match that lights. Not anymore the Wall Street protest. People won't be going to Wall Street. They'll be going to authority figures and authority, anything that represents authority in their society. Police, National Guards, sheriffs, local banks. That's where they're going to go. Not the kids. The kids are having a party, half of them, and the other half are concerned about bringing an issue to the social consciousness. That's where I see the derivatives playing a hidden role in all this off everyone's radar, not being discussed. And I'm concerned. Your thoughts, please.
Well, that's quite a scenario. It's not all that different from mine. I think that the danger here and what people fail to understand, because they say, you know, Greece is a long way away, it's a small economy, it's another nation. Well, the notion that the Greek workers who have all of a sudden going to have their wages, their pensions cut, their job security gone, that they're all of a sudden voluntarily going to take this and sing kumbaya around the fireplace as their government goes off merrily down the road is simply absurd. I think not only are we going to see spiraling violence and increasing unrest in Greece, but as you very succinctly pointed out, the real danger is that it spreads to the bigger economies. It moves to Italy, it moves to Portugal, it moves to Ireland. There's a little thing called inside the credit default swaps. We can look at the price of insurance. We can look at the price of these swaps. And the higher these prices go, and they're near record levels now, the higher these prices go, traders are telling you that they are perceiving that each of those nations is increasingly risky, increasingly at risk of default. Now, I do believe that Europe will split into a two-speed economy. I think it's going to be the haves and the have-nots. And the haves clearly are Germany and France. Everything else is going to roll downhill. People forget something else about the euro that is very puzzling to me, again, but here in the United States, you can kind of understand it. We deal with the dollar, and we're one nation. We're a big nation. We have several hundred million people. There, you have a political group that has ostensibly now taken on financial repercussions, the likes of which the world has never seen. The euro was formed as a politically expedient group. It wasn't a financial agreement. They came to a financial agreement, but the euro really is the joint assumption like a marriage. Now we're going to combine our checking accounts, and we're going to combine our spending, and we're going to combine all this. But what they didn't combine was the debt. Everybody inside the euro still has the ability to write as much debt as they want. And that's the problem here. So it's not recapitalizing the banks that's the issue, that everybody thinks. You know, that's a one-shot deal. What's really the problem is the trajectory of public spending in virtually every one of the European countries and here in the United States. That has got to be brought under control. Derivatives are simply bets placed upon the likelihood of that either being brought in control or, more appropriately, not being brought into control. So it's a very, very serious issue. China, I frequently refer to, love it or hate it, it is the only currency, the Chinese yuan is the only currency with adult supervision on the planet at the moment. It is clearly not perfect. But China is a nation that has had the world's largest GDP for 18 out of the last 20 centuries. They have 1.3 billion people. They have 3.1 or 2, depending on which data you review, $3.1 or $2 trillion in reserves. Our nation, according to the published figures, is $14.1 trillion in the hole. And then if you factor in Social Security, the medical complex, the defense complex that you were just speaking about before I got on, you're actually looking at $211 trillion in the hole. So this is perhaps the world's most serious financial crisis, the one that we've seen coming. It's like a train wreck in slow motion, and the middle class is being eviscerated. It makes me angry because it didn't have to be this way. But we're really talking about 40, 50, 60 years of cumulative economic policies that have been not only wrong but bad decisions. And that's really, I think the crux of this. Derivatives are a byproduct. They should be repudiated. They should be made illegal. These folks should be called onto the carpet and made to explain them.
I agree with that. I would suggest that I'm out there. In fact, I'll be out for the next 62 days on the road by myself. I travel alone in a car, filming the last part of a major series. It started off being one film. Now it's a 52-part series.
My goodness.
On Poverty, Inc. Mm-hmm. And so the only way you can do it is you got to get out there. You have to go into their shops and their homes, spend a day, and talk with them. And let them talk as a human being and see that, because none of them are being represented in the media or in marches.
And these are the poor working poor.
The
worst thing, Doc, is they're not even being represented in Washington.
Not at all.
As far as I'm concerned.
You're right.
This is government at the people, not government by the people. It's not even government for the people. This is fascism. Washington. This is government at the people, and I think that is critically wrong. I think that we are reaching a flashpoint in this country where I'm an optimist at heart, where we are going to see some true change. And I think that ideally those 535 people in Congress and at the head of our government and across various branches are going to realize not only how disingenuous they have been, but just how out of touch they actually are. I suspect we will see panic among our elected officials when they realize that Americans, millions of Americans, have finally, truly, legitimately had it. This is no longer a Democratic problem. This is no longer a Republican problem. This is not a Tea Party problem. This is not even a problem for Martians, as far as I'm concerned. This is a problem for every human being on the planet, and the central bankers have got to get out of the way. They're wrong. They've been wrong. They continue to be wrong. Our leaders continue to be wrong. We need to get back to the founding principles of many of these nations, which are things like equal representation, voice of the people, the common good. Those are the types of things I think
it won't happen quickly.
And it will not be smooth either.
No, it's going to be really ragged, because when I'm talking with people, I'm talking with people that you would think are just your regular, conscientious people. They pride themselves on their virtues and their values. They tend to be more conservative in financially. They don't understand why they're having to suffer. As one person just told me that I just filmed, they've never done anything wrong.
Exactly.
And now their house is underwater, and they can't afford to make the payments. And they feel guilt and shame about not being able to do that. But no one in Washington's really speaking on their behalf.
Well, and on top of that,
they're angry.
They're having their wealth involuntarily redistributed.
That's correct. To the wealthiest.
You know, not even to the wealthiest. They're having it redistributed to the government.
Yeah, and the government then makes sure that the military-industrial complex, the energy cartels, the food cartels, all of the cartels and all the special interests represented by K Street, they are first in line with their handout. Even the National Academy of Sciences, all of these different scientists who get all this money and institutions never do anything. It ends up curing diseases, but boy, they get the money. But I'll tell you, the average person's sick of this, and the next time around, it won't be a bunch of, you know, passive, almost 99% passive kids in the streets who aren't that aware of history, geography. They are aware of the issue. They have different backgrounds. I'm talking about hardcore, real Americans who are angry. And how many am I talking about? About 65 million. And what's the difference?
Right.
They're not going to go to Wall Street. They've got arms. And as I've had them tell me this time and again, man, I'm so angry. If something happens, I'm going to just lose it. Now, what do you think is going to happen when someone, maybe something that's simple, two marshals go over to evict a person, and suddenly the guy says, I'm not leaving, and the SWAT team's brought in, leave, they don't, the guy gets killed. You think that's not going to cause a flash fire? When this starts, it'll be like the Texas flash fires that destroyed over 2 million acres this summer. That's what I predict you're going to see, and I predict it in the next 2 years. Anyhow, Keith, thank you very much for giving us your insights and telling us the truth about the $600 trillion derivative time bomb that no one is talking about. I'm glad you are. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for your time, and thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Put your sweet lips a little closer to the phone. Let's pretend that we're together.
That's the music I grew up with down in the hills of West Virginia. Yeah. Old country music. I'd like to welcome you all. We have a lot more program to go, and I'm going to open up our call lines now for you to call in and share your thoughts on any of the things we discuss. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Don't forget, you can download Monday evening's program, Progressive Commentary Hour. Progressive Commentary Hour, it's up there. Powerful show. Now I've got a special for you. And next week, I'm introducing three brand new products. I'd introduce them now, but they're coming in tomorrow, so I'll wait till next week to introduce them. Really some hot stuff, some delicious stuff. But here's our two superstars, and I'm going to give you the deal of a lifetime today on them. Here it is, the new and improved Red Stuff, the all-natural, raw, 34 fruits, enzymes, and probiotics. And just think of what you're getting here. You're getting the tomatoes, high milligrams, 900 milligrams. You're getting the tart cherry, apple pectin, acerola, mangosteen, organic flaxseed powder, prune, macai berry, blood oranges, red wine extract. By the way, 650 milligrams. Do you know how rare it is to find any product anywhere that gives you 650 milligrams of red wine extract? Normally, it's about 50 milligrams. I gave you the industrial strength here. Prune extract, plums, oranges, pears, pomegranate, mango, watermelon, papaya, passion fruit, kiwis, green tea, 250 milligrams. There you are. Bromelain, whoa, we all need that. 200 milligrams, three different types, four types of digestive enzymes, amylase, lipase, salase, papain. Ah, superstar. Resveratrol, 175 milligrams, cinnamon, another superstar, ginger root, and guess what? 8 billion probiotics, non-dairy, lactobacillus acidophilus, lactobacillus thermophilus, lactobacillus cassia, bifidus bacterium longum, bifidus bacteria breve. And that's what you get. How many calories? 40. Low glycemic index, no processed sugars. And that's the new and improved Red Stuff. And on top of that, I added 10,000 ORAC, the extra antioxidants that really make this power. And then I'm adding the new and improved Green Stuff. So you're getting your greens and your red together today. Raw, all natural, 10,000 ORAC. And you're getting arugula, collard greens, onions, broccoli sprouts, radish, parsley, asparagus, kale, oat beta-glucan, broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, celery, spirulina, chlorella, spinach, barley grass juice, and apple pectin. So that's the new and improved Red Stuff, new and improved Green Stuff. And today, you're also getting the documentary, Building Your Immune System Naturally. This is a really comprehensive two-hour documentary. Dr. Joan Priestley, Dr. Marjorie Siebert, Dr. Sheila Gorge, Dr. Zhang, Dr. Alan Sachs, Dr. Brown, and HOTUS. You have all these experts on how to identify your weakened immune system, how to build it, how to strengthen it, how to expand it, how to have it protect you. What's this package go for? Well, normally it would be $221.84. What am I going to offer to you today? $124.99, almost $98 savings, the most I've ever done on this. So give a call. This is it. This is your opportunity. The new and improved Green Stuff, new and improved Red Stuff. Boy, do I take a lot of that with me when I travel. I take a case of it, each one. Well, I take nine different powders when I travel. And now you get all this. Only $124.99, a $98 savings. Call now. 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, or visit our vitamin closet at 307 East 92nd Street, right off 2nd Avenue, noon to 6, or our 83rd and Broadway vitamin closet, if you want to pick them up in person. Now, we've got a whole lot of people on the phone here. Let's go down to Virginia and say hello to Virginia. Hi, Virginia from Virginia.
Yeah, hi, Gary. You were talking about hydrofracking the other day, and I wanted to know if you thought that had anything to do with this earthquake from hell that scared me to death the other day.
Well, only first of all, you were probably one of the few people that really combined the two, and that's good. Because hydrofracking, we haven't been able to prove it, but there's a lot of evidence that it weakens the infrastructure of rock and plates underneath, and especially when you have a great deal of it and they're very deep. And so that's why I believe that we have to do more research, but I'm on that now. We're doing an anti-fracking campaign. We're doing an anti-nuclear campaign. And hopefully you have watched Knocking on the Devil's Door. And if you haven't, get the documentary and watch it, because we all have to work together. We've brought the hydrofracking group, anti-hydrofracking group, and the anti-nuclear groups together. We're working with one concept, stop them both. And we have the evidence to prove they're both bad. But we do not have absolute evidence that the hydrofracking either contributes to or exacerbates the earthquake. But we are suspecting that it does. But that's merely a hypothesis that needs to be proven, but we're working on it. All right?
Bye-bye.
And just imagine the poor people down in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C., who are having some really rough sex with the lights out, and they thought that heavy-duty hydrofracking they were doing. The earthquake was just one big orgasm. Thank you, Virginia. Let's say hello to Jose from New York. Hi, Jose.
Hello, Gary. Last week in September, one of your shows, you talked about individuals with HIV and zero T cells that are in good health. I'd like to learn more about that.
All right. Then you can go up online and read the in-depth report, AIDS is Second Opinion. It's about 600 pages. It lists the protocols of how that was achieved, the full protocols, about 128 pages of protocols alone, and gives you actual patient testimonies and the science behind that. Okay? And let's say hello to David from the Lower East Side. Hi, David.
How you doing, Gary?
Doing good.
About 2 days ago, you pretty much stated that The Roosevelt and Eisenhower presidents from the left and from the right, you refer to them as highly ethical and moral, presidents compared to what's going on.
Not moral. I said that they represented the true conservative Republican virtues and the true liberal Democrat virtues.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference in the virtues of what someone represents versus the pure morality of them. I don't think any politician is purely moral. But compared to what we have today, is a completely different type of conservative and different type of liberal virtues. That's the context in which I said it. But please continue.
Okay, because from the American standpoint, the way they benefited during that era when they were presidents, the labor and all the contributions they have done and the things they have made, changes that they created in the laws that were virtually non-existent thanks to the banking cartels, the brutality of which they went around the rest of the world and exploited them is what I had a problem with. So I probably misinterpreted some of your statement.
Yes, if you heard me earlier, I did a 3.5-hour special in-depth investigative report entitled In the Name of Intervention, the Name of Democracy, Peace, and Freedom. And I showed in each and every country, from Haiti to undermining the democratic process in the election in the Italian election in the 1950s, how all this, the CIA was behind it, and the CIA was behind it, and the White House supported that. Whether it was a Democratic president or a Republican president, they all supported intervening because they were all aligned with special interest groups, including large corporate special interest groups. So that's also what I would be opposed to. I'm talking about what they considered the values of their party. For example, the Liberal Democrats under Roosevelt installed the Glass-Steagall Act, as an example, which helped protect the American public from having a banking system that was out of control and merging the savings and loan with commercial banks, and so that they could engage in unlimited amounts of transactions without holding to their reserve policies. No, that was that. You know, they did some good things, very good things. But at the end of the day, it was not the federal funding and federal spending by itself that got us out of the Great Depression. It was World War II that got us out of the Depression, and the enormous amount of money we spent and the debt that occurred from that to build up a whole war machine, and also the businesses in America that started to kick in. So I'm glad that you now understand the context in which I was sharing that. And let's say hello to Elizabeth in studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. There's an email here. I'd like to read parts of it and to give you the main points. The lady's name is Lenora Paglia, and she says, I never knew about your excellent radio program until this past summer, when the circumstances of my workplace changed and I was afforded the freedom to listen to my own choice of radio station at midday. Your show is an oasis in today's desert of insipid mass media infotainment. Thank you for courageously, positively and engagingly broadcasting real ideas, real research, real issues, real arguments and real solutions. The Progressive Radio Network is truly the thinking person's toolbox. I wish you all the best in reaching exponentially increasing audiences around the world. And she goes on to say, you have addressed many important issues that receive no coverage and presented points of views that are just not heard but really need to be. The polarizing arguments in mainstream media are infuriatingly shallow, and the American public deserve better. We desperately need people like you to help us articulate the nuances of our important national dialogues. On the basis of the clearly growing public awareness of nuclear power plant dangers alone, I believe you are having profound effect. I can't believe that more than 30, she says the issue is still up for debate, and she says your documentary film is a great contribution. In the context of the Occupy Wall Street movement, kudos for recently pointing out the troublesome paradox of modern technology, on the one hand being the means by which progressive movements may organize and disseminate information, and yet simultaneously being something bound up in the problems of globalization, with gadgets being made in China, etc. I am troubled by how much computer technology has co-opted resources and supplanted certain traditional, sometimes better entities in all sectors of our culture, ranging from diminishing mom-and-pop shopping options to the demise of formal, closely edited and fact-checking print publications. As someone who spent some time studying at the now 800-year-old University of Cambridge, I also was uncomfortable with the assumption that electronic equipment is necessary for education or for the independent thinking that leads to discovery. She talks about how she goes into a public high school in New York City and she's just dismayed by the fact that all the books have gone and it now looks like some back room at NASA. She says, I wonder what all of this cost and its anticipated point of obsolescence is projected to be, and really just how much it all impacts the students' actual education, especially in light of the fact that it has completely supplanted real books. What are the cost-benefit analyses for these expensive experimental ventures? From what I can tell, American education has literally been sold a wholesale bill of goods by the technology companies. I want to share these thoughts with you, as this particular contrarian point of view is something that I haven't heard articulated. I'm not anti-technology, but I do believe that technology has been embraced far too uncritically. I believe that not only financial resources have been squandered, but too much time and energy in the realm of education is being channeled into fun and marveling over electronic toys at the expense of time better dedicated to the hard work of actual subject mastery and making impossible the uncluttered mental space needed for real free thinking and meaningful creativity. Thank you once again for offering a well-informed, non-conformist perspective on so many topics.
That's very nice. What's her name?
Leonora Paglia.
Paglia. Leonora. Yeah. Well, Leonora, thank you very much for that. We're out of time. I'd like to thank all of you for taking your time. We will take on the issues that are relevant, are important, with a contrarian point of view from the establishment, either left or right. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day. Stay tuned for Mike Fader.